Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live. Hello, you are listening to The Film Show. I'm Denise.
Am I in the right studio?
Yeah. To the film show.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yes.
All you mugs who are paying twice as much as you need to for a meal tonight.
And not us.
Very expensive flowers and a card. And if you don't do it, you're going to get the ump from your partner, you know.
And why have we opened with a different piece of music? I hear you ask.
This is our Valentine's Day special show.
A show of love. Doomed love.
And we're going to be talking about some of our favourite romantic films.
With doom.
One of mine, which is Brief Encounter.
And more about that later.
And I'm going to be ruining it for all of you out there.
Yeah, spoilers for an 80-year-old film.
Spoilers, yeah. If you haven't seen it, well, you've had enough.
You've had 80 years, go on.
Get on with it. Right, some news. There's been a bit of a argy-bargy at the Berlin Film Festival. This week, where Wim Wenders made an opening speech where he said that movies should steer away from any political content, saying that movies can change the world, but not in a political way. Filmmakers have to stay out of politics, because if we make movies that are dedicatedly political, we enter the field of politics, but we are the counterweight of politics. We are the opposite of politics. We have to do the work of people, not the work of politicians. I think this went down like a lead balloon, I think, yes. for quite a few people. Most notably, the Indian Booker Prize-winning novelist Arundhati Roy, who was going to have one of her films shown at the festival. Now, she's removed herself completely from the festival and has made quite a stringent retort about some of the ideas that Wenders was putting over in this speech. What think you, Denise?
I mean, life is politics, isn't it? Like, you can't...
Well, it's the whole thing that people say, well, everything's political.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. A book, a piece of music, a TV show.
What do you think Wim Wenders' motives are, though?
Is he? I don't know. But Germany's going through a really weird period at the moment with how it's dealing with Gaza and Israel, where they are taking a very, very hard line with pro-Palestinian protesters, aren't they?
Yes.
And I don't know if this is... I really don't know if this is something we're having to sort of fall in line with what a general view of things is. But, I mean, there are so many films that you can think of that are, you know, openly political. And you think, well, there wouldn't have been any point making them unless...
Well, sometimes just making something about something is a political choice. Yeah. You can't avoid it.
And what do you do? Do you, I would say something like Pontecorvo's Battle of Algiers. Now, there is a political film that shows you how to carry out a coup, how to carry out a revolution, as it shows how the Algerian resistance rose up against his French occupiers and got rid of the French occupation in the late 50s, early 60s. And all the politics that's involved in that, it's all there. And it's discussed as well. So although you can tell where Pontecorvo's coming from, it's not a mindless piece of propaganda. And, well... if you go into propaganda movies, well, they're all going to be political anyway, aren't they? But I don't know. I don't think it was the time and place to be saying that. And I can see why Roy was so upset.
I mean,
as
well, know your audience.
Oh, yeah.
That's not really going to go down well
there,
is it? Because filmmakers are kind of like congratulating themselves on making that kind of film.
And it's that sort of thing... Again, something of a sweeping statement, but a lot of people working in the cultural sector tend to be more progressive than right-wing, I would say. A sweeping statement, maybe, but, you know,
Well, it's interesting you were saying about the German line on that. So the High Court in... our High Court has just sort of... decided or just ruled that the Palestine Action Ban was unlawful, hasn't it? So
They are going to appeal it, but I think for now they're not going to do any further arrests, but they will be gathering evidence. But to me, it always looked ridiculous where you're carting away old age pensioners
in
wheelchairs.
Look,
probably say no more, the show will be just be left over to that. but it all looked silly, didn't it?
Yeah.
And it undermined whatever it was they were trying to do. So anyway, that's a bit less for the lineup for this year's Berlin Film Festival.
Scrambling around.
Hit it. Am I doing this way?
Oh yeah.
James Van Der Beek. I thought this is...
You thought this would be up my street, did you?
Well, this is your time. You would have been...
No.
You would have been, Mum, Dawson's Creek song, can I watch it? Can I stay up for Dawson's Creek?
No, I think you've misjudged my childhood. I was watching screwball comedies and weird things I'd taped off Channel 4 in the evening.
I was watching French New Wave films when I was 8 years. No, you weren't.
Well, this is James Van Der Beek, American actor.
James Van Der Beek, American actor, who was one of the stars of Dawson's Creek.
I mean, he was a teen superstar, wasn't he?
And I have to admit, I don't know. I know very little about him. I've never watched an episode of Dawson's Creek. But he was the dog's... Whatever they've got between their legs, wasn't he, at that time? He really was a massive, massive...
He was beloved.
Star. Yes, yeah, beloved.
Beloved.
My favourite word at the moment. Not. And he was diagnosed with cancer only 2 years ago. Mm. And it took hold and has very, very swiftly taken him from us. So he's been quite... ill for a few years now, unable to work properly. He did venture into some film roles and was working still up until about, I think, 2022. Mm. He's very good in The Rules of Attraction, where he plays Sean Bateman, who's Patrick Bateman's brother in the Brent Easton Ellis universe. And he's very, very good in that as a pretty nasty drug dealer. So he had some range. And I think in Dawson's Creek, he was like, the character he played was wanting to be a film director, was mad about Spielberg, I believe. And they've had to put out a GoFundMe because his medical bills have just been enormous. And apparently Steven Spielberg has donated $25,000 towards his medical bills, which I thought was a nice,
a nice
touch.
Katie Holmes, obviously launched her career at Dawson's Creek, and it was a kind of a well, they won't lay love story between them. But I didn't watch it, Martin.
Same here.
I was. It was the '90s. I was in the pub a lot.
Let's not go there. Literally, let's not go there. Okay.
But a global star.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have...
Are you doing this one?
I wouldn't be able to do him justice. I've only seen two of his films, but they are iconic. You're another of your favourite words.
Beloved.
Beloved and iconic.
Both are masterpieces.
Bud Cort.
Yes. A weird-looking, thin, very thin, boyish actor who in the late 60s, early 70s, would turn up in lots of Robert Altman films.
Well, that's the two I've seen, obviously, probably the most famous as well, Harold and Maude, but also Brewster McLeod, which
Brewster
is
McLeod.
An odd, not odd film.
Well, that is bonkers, yeah. Brewster McLeod. Mm. And he's in MASH.
Yeah, who is he playing, MASH?
I don't think he was one of the characters that carried over onto the TV series. And I think he turns up in a few other Altman films. And he had this sort of, like, American indie sort of career where he would turn up in small movies every now and again, you know. And, and his name carried quite a lot of cachet. But Harold and Maude is probably his most famous film. And...
Our friend Mel loves Harold and Maude.
Yeah. And the film that probably encapsulates his career best. It's he's a young, about 20-year-old.
Yeah, he's obsessed with going to funerals and death, isn't he? And he forms an alliance and a romance. With an octogenarian. Basically,
Ruth Gordon.
More doomed love.
Yeah,
in theme with the show.
And they fall in love and have a. It's very obvious that they have a sexual relationship in the film. So it was like breaking all sorts of taboos. And that has become, again, another tired phrase, but something of a cult classic since it was released. Was it 71 or something? 70, somewhere back there. it's an old movie now, you know. I think that's probably the one he'll be remembered most for.
It's a very interesting time in American filmmaking, though, isn't it? That Altman, that whole Altman scene and these just little... I think they're sort of partly influenced, but I think you were talking about this the other week, actually. I listened to the show. But that influence of the French New Wave had on smaller filmmaking in America as well.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, it was like lots of change going on in all different places, I think. And like these things were feeding into each other, weren't they? And, you know, Altman ended up having his Altman style, didn't he? His people wandering on screen, mumbling their lines.
Well, I mean, the opening of Brewster McCloud is very strange, isn't it? It's got, like, the MGM logo, and then someone... And then it's just... It isn't the lion's roar. It's someone going, I forgot what to say, or something.
Yeah, you're right.
And the premise of it is just really odd. It's a young man... He's kind of reclusive, isn't he, the Bud Cork character?
He lives in the Houston Astrodome.
Yeah. He's sort of hiding out, and he's trying to create some wings so that he can fly. Yeah. He just wants to fly, basically.
And he does.
Yeah.
Right. So, goodbye to those. Hope someone dies next week that Denise actually knows.
Well, no, I do know Bud Cork, but I didn't know a lot of his career.
Did you have a nice week, or 2 weeks?
Oh, right? You stalked me to London. While you were in two places at once, right? So I went down for a gig. I went to see, get as much culture in as you can while you're there, kind of thing. So I took in a couple of exhibitions. One of them, the Turner and Constable exhibition at the National. No, not the National. That was the other week. Tate Britain. I'm wandering around. You're on air at this time. And as I'm walking into a room, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder how the show's going.
Were you listening to me?
Was I Eckers-like? But I was wondering how the show was going. I was looking forward to catching it up later on Sheffield Live online. Look up the film show. You can easily listen to our last four shows. You were there on the screen. And I was like, what the? And I I'd already had a couple of posh people telling me off for not behaving correctly in the gallery. And then I was like, Martin, what are you doing? And it was the clip from Mr. Turner where they go into the... Because it was a Turner Constable exhibition.
Yes, the big room.
Your moment.
Yes.
Yeah. Can't even leave me alone
one
when
of
I.
My moments.
I had 2 weeks off, to be fair.
Yeah. maybe it was a hallucination yet.
No, I took a photo and sent it to you. Oh, you can verify.
Did you? Yeah, I did. It was me. I've got to get on to my agent. Okay, then.
Film star.
Music, what are we doing for music?
Well, no, aren't we doing some trailer trash first?
Oh, sorry, I've forgotten to trailer trash.
The Peaky Blinders.
Yes, there's a lot of Peaky Blinders stuff coming up in the next few weeks. The Peaky Blinders...
By the way, sorry, just while we're on the Cillian Murphy trail. Yeah. I did hear you say the other week... Denise had watched Cillian Murphy in Mr. Ben, and now I do want to see Cillian Murphy in Mr. Ben, specifically in the changing rooms. I think.
I think we should write a pilot for him, then, shouldn't we?
Think about it, Cillian. Come on, stop doing all these serious films.
But there's a Peaky Blinders feature film coming out. Peaky Blinders, the
Immortal Man.
I think it's set in the early 1950s.
Yeah, and it's when did we leave off the TV series? How far
was that? Was it the beginning of the Second World War?
Yeah, I don't think we got to the war
because there were Mosley and the fascists.
So
this is going to be.
And that's quite nice because the TV series starts after the First World War. It's post First World War, so it's kind of an interesting.
And there have been two more series of the TV series commissioned as well.
Have there? Oh, I didn't catch that.
Apparently so. I don't know much of the detail on that, but apparently they have been commissioned. Now, whether or not Cillian is in that, I'm not exactly sure. But he's all over this this new film. I think Rebecca Ferguson is in it.
She's good.
Guess what? Stephen Graham's in it. You wouldn't have thought that, would you? You wouldn't have thought that. Well, as I look down the cart, I thought, well, Olivia's got to be here somewhere. Unless she's just doing a cameo, you know.
Well, it's out in March.
Yeah,
it's very, very soon. It's on Netflix March the 20th, but yeah. I think it's cinemas from the 6th.
Yes, yeah. So you've got to see it on that.
But it looks very moody. It looks very Peaky Blinders moody, but he's got a gentler haircut than the traditional Peaky Blinders haircut in the trailer, which is important.
He's got to keep with the time, didn't he? He should have a...
His grey's coming through, but you'll be pleased to learn he still looks absolutely beautiful. And what's the other trailer? I haven't seen the other trailer. Tuna.
It's called Tuna.
Tuna?
Because I went to see Crime 101 yesterday. Mm. And so there was a couple of trailers for like heist movies.
Oh.
So, and then this is, Tuna is a film with Dustin Hoffman and a couple of young actors. I don't know who they are. And it's about this guy who's a piano tuner and his acute sense of hearing allows him to fall in with a bunch of safecrackers. And instead of them blowing the safe up, he can hear. But they're Russian mobsters, so it all starts to go a bit naughty.
You've got to be careful with Russian mobsters, ain't you?
I told him, I said, leave it out. Although they're in America, and Ray Winston isn't.
I'm slightly disappointed now.
I told you. I don't know. I've gone off of Dustin Hoffman recently.
Have you? Well,
even in like the old films, you know.
I've noticed there's a little bit of a backlash against him on those, like, you know, those videos that appear on social media where there's a clip from Kramer versus Kramer. You know the scene where he smashes the wine glass against the wall?
Yeah.
Well, Meryl Streep didn't know about that, and he made sure to let the cameraman know. So that the cameraman would catch his bit, but he didn't tell his fellow actor. And there's a lot of stuff like that now, where you look at that. That's a bit. That's a bad move. Yeah.
That could have, you know, your glass could have gone in her face or something.
It's just disrespectful.
No, we've had enough of you now.
Enough of that now. Right, we've decided.
Put it away.
Put Dustin back in the box.
Are we having some music now, then?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I've picked some tracks on the theme of doomed love this week. Cheery stuff. This is from a film called Cold War.
L'orage pouvait bien éclater à nos yeux. Nous étions brûlants et pressés, amoureux. Le pendule a tué les temps qui de nous retiendra l'instant des amants. Tout ce que l'on s'était promis, amoureux. Nos querelles couvraient la musique, où l'on s'évolait la réplique. Nos larmes nous avaient trahis peu à peu. Des yeux malheureux, il a fallu cesser le feu comme on peut. Sombre regarde qui pleures-tu donc à la fenêtre, les givres font et même
Oh, that was from 2018's Cold War. Another film of doomed love set in the 1950s Cold War. Paul Paleski directed that, and that was Joanna Kulig singing the theme from the film.
Lovely. Okay, so we're going to be talking about romantic films now for a bit, and I'm going to talk a bit about Brief Encounter.
Yeah.
Because it's a film... It's a film I absolutely love.
I was surprised when you said that you love this film.
I absolutely adore it. Because every time I watch it, I see something else in it.
I must say, it is a rewatch film, isn't
and
it?
Every time there'll be a line of dialogue. Mm. There might even be a glance between two people. You think, oh, it picks up on
but also,
people.
As you get older, you change your viewpoints on the characters. Yeah.
So... From my point of view, it's like, you know, people, oh, it's all about love and... no. And that's why I think it's an incredibly complex film. I think the thing that you have to remember about it, it was made in 1945. It won the Grand Prix at Cannes in 1946, along with 10 other films. There was a bit of a backlog. It's not set in 1945.
No, it's set pre-war. In the 1930s. Yeah.
And that, all of a sudden, really, that changes everything about it. And I think it's just through the passage of time. A lot of people watching it in years gone by have sort of lost that. It's a black and white film. It was made at the end of the war. It must be during the war, and it's not.
Mm.
I mean, and it's the story. I think it's a really.
But obviously,
story.
Like anything though, made during the war, it's influenced incredibly by politics. And,
yes, you know. Yes. Mm. I'll give Vim Vendors a call. About
yeah.
and it's. I mean, I think it's very much about the social changes because the story is two married people who meet up on a train station, Milford Junction, which is actually Carnforth Station in Lancashire. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't. I do want to go now because I've rewatched it this week, yeah, ready for this.
You need to go because you know they've got the tea room and all that stuff. But
the tea room wasn't filmed there, though, was it? It's filmed in
that
a
was
studio.
In the studio, yeah. And they meet. They both get trains home on Thursday evenings from Milford Junction, where Alec is working at the hospital, where he's a doctor. Laura goes into Milford to get a book, do some shopping. She gets a book from Boots, a light romance.
And this is what women did.
And
women of the home.
Mm. And she goes to the pictures to see... You know, well, she ain't going to see a Bellatar film. This is quite light. And this sets off so that's the first one. It's seven Thursdays this takes.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And next week he bumps into her outside booth. Hello, that's you again.
It kind of pursues her.
And they part.
Mm.
Third weekend, she goes to the Cardoma restaurant for a lunch every Thursday. He comes in and there's nowhere else to sit apart from at her table. And from there, they go to the pictures, don't they?
Yeah, they go to the pictures. They go for a drive in the country.
Not on that one.
No, I thought we were skipping to the...
Well, anyway...
Going to go on every date.
These things sort of start moving a little bit more. They do a little bit more on each weekend. And then I think it's the fourth or the fifth weekend is where Alec gets the car and they go out into the countryside. And he tries to get her back
to his friend's flat.
Where they could have an assignation. But his friend comes back early and it all goes. And so they meet just one more time, which is probably one of the most tragic... depressing afternoons ever committed to film.
I love the way that it opens with that ending.
Yeah.
And then you come to see the significance
all this information. And there's one moment, Alec's final moment with Laura is he puts his hand
I can see it, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, the power.
And
of
she
that.
Can't. She can't even look back at him, no, though, to just, see him go off the train.
So this is really a doomed love affair.
Mm.
But
except.
I just think people say, "Oh well, you know," as you say, in the '30s, it's showing 1930s attitudes, certainly middle class attitudes, mm. that divorce would have been completely. No, you can't do that. It'd be shocking. But this is 1945 when this film is going out. There's been a million American GIs in Britain. There's been loads of British men that haven't been there. There have been wives, girlfriends, mothers, sisters who
not only are separated, but also any day could be their last.
Yeah.
There's a sense of, well, it's so dangerous anyway.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, well, who knows? Mm. I could get blown up by a German bomber tonight. And I think it's more a warning of not to go back to those repressive ideas of the 1930s. Mm. You know, we had a break from that, and maybe we should take on board some of that freedom.
But also, I mean, it's written by Noel Coward, who is a gay man at a time when you can't be a gay man.
Yes.
So,
and you know, some say, well, are Alec and Stephen, the owner of the flat, are they a gay couple?
Mm.
Is that why Stephen is so angry with Alec?
But interestingly, that's the only scene in the film, isn't it?
Well, that's the key.
Yeah, which is not...
The key question is oh, I should say, all of this is a flashback from Laura's point of view.
Yeah.
When she's got home, she sits down and she reminisces about these seven Thursdays.
But that scene in the flat with Stephen, she's not there.
And so Laura is not a reliable narrator. And she conjures up this story of what goes on. She runs out of the flat, Stephen comes in, remonstrates a little with Alec, and she runs through the streets of Milford in the pouring rain, almost hysterical. And you say, well, but that she doesn't know that was how it happened. And then when you start looking at the structure of the thing, is all about Alec chasing after her. Alec tells her he loves her. Yeah. She doesn't tell him.
Oh, no, stop it. Don't go on.
Don't. it's the sheer violence of love that I can't stand. And it's always Alec sort of pushing it. And she is full of these romantic dreams of what she doesn't...
There's a lovely little montage, isn't there, when she's on the train.
Yeah.
And like the train is almost like a fantasy journey, but it's taken her back to a reality with her husband, Fred.
Yeah.
But she's... Is it in the window? I can't...
She's reflecting.
She's reflecting because she's dreaming.
So she looks in the window.
She goes off dancing with them. They're driving in the...
And so this is what her life doesn't have.
Mm. Well, I mean, the first time she goes home as well after that... Well, it's actually... She goes home and there's those two awful children.
Like,
mummy,
appalling,
mummy, tell whatever the other girl called.
Tell
it's my birthday. We're doing my thing. And I'm like, oh, my life. No wonder she wants to run off with this geezer.
I'm going to chew up about those two kids, which round up anyway. Mm. But yeah, so at the end of it, I think you could say she made it all up. This is like an extended...
I mean, that's a bold claim.
Like, I am bold. But, you know, this is the... Maybe he took that piece of grit out of her.
Yeah, and then it went on.
And then this is what she's like made up. Because, I mean, half the time she doesn't even meet him anyway on these Thursdays.
Yeah.
You know, oh, we could have done that, and we could have done this. And at the end, she's there with Fred in that home, which is like a prison.
Fred knows, though, I think. Fred is...
Oh, yeah, Fred
like,
knows.
Because it... But that's the thing, because it goes on. There's all these open, well, secret but open relationships.
Yes, because
you can't.
He's got suspicions, hasn't he? But he's also got no real interest in her, isn't he? He's not going to.
Oh no, I don't know. I think he.
No, I don't think he has.
Well, he's not going to take her boating and dancing, and he's not going to.
So I think it's a great tragedy, but I've got very briefly, I've got an idea for a brief encounter too. Okay. Fred joins the British Union of Fascists and is imprisoned. And Laura, Laura manages to get a divorce from him. Now, I have to say, we're in the late 30s here. Very soon, early 40s, you know, there's this huge American Air Force base that opens just outside of Milford, where she works there. She's a PA secretary or something like that, you know, and everybody loves her. She's very brisk, efficient and all that. And she starts having a relationship with a dashing young American airman. And at the end of the war, they get married and they go back to California and they live in California and they're very, very happy. They have this dream life in, Los Angeles. It's got to be Los Angeles, actually. And the kids go with them and the kids have a wonderful childhood. But they join the Manson family.
Oh, my life, Martin.
That's brief encounter two. Laura gets a birth. You can't please everyone. But I think Brief Encounter is one of the greatest films ever made. And it's just something you can go back to time and time. And every time I sit there wishing, you know, don't do that. No, go, do that. Yeah. Like, you know, just wishing. Oh. Take control, Laura. There you go.
Well, I
have you recovered from?
I don't agree that it's made up, but I'm interested in that theory.
No, but I think it's a film that leaves itself open to a number of different readings. I think, and so I'm not saying, that's how I deal with it almost because I find it such a tragic film.
I love watching that film alongside the other David Lee Noel Coward Second World War films, in Which We Serve and This Happy Breed.
Have you seen The Passionate Friend?
I have, yes.
I mean, that's weird. Mm. That's almost like, well, the first half is a bit like Brief Encounter, and then it goes off somewhere else, doesn't it? But it's a great film.
Oh, see, I have an... During like the late 90s to the mid noughties, I was very much drawn to doomed romance kind of films. And one of my favourites, The English Patient, 1997, Anthony Minghella. And that is another unreliable narrator type affair because you've got Ralph Fiennes' Count Onashis. Is at the opening of the film, he's crashed a plane. We're in the desert somewhere. He's rescued by a wandering tribe who fixes burns as best they can. And he ends up in this British hospital. And they don't know who he is. So they just decide, English? Probably English. That's why he's called the English Patient. He's a Hungarian. And then we go through a series of flashbacks when he is being moved by Juliette Binoche's Hannah, who's a nurse, a French-Canadian nurse. And she starts hearing his stories of the pre-war, where he is part of an expedition trying to explore parts of Africa. And he falls in love with Kristen Scott Thomas's Catherine Clifton, who is married to Colin Firth's Geoffrey. And they have a torrid affair. And Hannah, in the meantime, has, in our current time, in the Second World War in Italy, has a relationship with Kip, who is played by Naveen Andrews, who is an Indian bomb disposal member of the British Army. The stories of how Count Onashis and Catherine Clifton have got together, and they have a torrid affair, but then she ends it and he cannot accept it. And it just destroys everybody around them. I adore this film and I adore crying at this film and the tragedy of it because there's doomed love all over the place. Because, again, the Second World War is like this backdrop of in Casablanca, this doesn't add up to a whole hill of beans, does it? We're just two people. But it's having this massive backdrop of all of these things happening to and affecting everybody so badly. But and yet, you've still got the conceit to go, but look at this love story. Look at these two. Isn't it tragic? And you're like, well, you should be going, this tragedy is everywhere, but you're focused on the tragedy of this doomed love. I absolutely adore it. But I was quite susceptible to that kind of thing because I was single and I'd been out with a series of useless men.
And then, how far you
take it? Well, so when Atonement came out in 2007, and that's another, that is, I don't know if you know the, so I'd read the book.
No, I'm not familiar with the film or the book.
It's really difficult to talk about without spoiling it. And I don't want to spoil it, but there is, the central premise of it is there is an unreliable narrator who is a writer.
Yeah.
And I won't go any further than that. But it's interesting that we were talking about Brief Encounter and that sense of someone telling the story.
Yeah.
Why.
Do you find out that he's an unreliable narrator?
In Atonement,
yeah.
It's a fiction within a fiction. Yeah.
Brief Encounter, that's for you.
Yeah, that's your theory. That's your take on it. Yeah.
The film's not actually.
Whereas Atonement, it's explicitly you are explicitly led down a road and then told.
Yeah, that's it.
That ain't how it was.
But then, and the reason why I think that about Brief Encounter is there are so many nudges and clues to it, so many references. It's not just that.
You know,
it's this and this and this. And the way the characters are built up, and then sometimes undermined as well, you know. That I think now, and as you said, with Coward, maybe thinking, well, you know, do we really want to go back to not that homosexuality was going to be made legal for another 20 years or so, but you know, there would have been social advances made during the Second World War that would have been almost unbelievable in the late 1930s.
Do you, when you watch Brief Encounter, does it make you, because I know you like a cry, you like a cry at the films, does it make you cry? Or does it just make you think and feel a bit melancholy or, like?
Melancholy, it does, because it's, if I take it as, you know, it is actually happening. It's two people trapped in the class strictures.
Whereas by my two films here, like The English Patient and Atonement, you've got the amped up.
There's a narrative.
Yeah, you are sent out of there snotting.
Yeah. But you know, at the end of the day, Brief Encounter has this narrative black hole in the centre of it. And I was reading a few things. I said, oh, Lean and Coward made a mistake with that. No, they didn't. I forgot that. Yes, she's not there. Well, no one will notice. That's there for a reason, I think. And I don't think it would be that David Lean and Noel Coward forgot about that. But if you don't want to take that line, I've no problem with that.
But it is a film that you can rewatch Brief Encounter, isn't it, so many times and look at it from a different angle.
Yeah.
You
get different hints, you know, that's telling you the war ain't on. Things like that, you know.
There is the two soldiers, isn't there, that come into the... they're not sympathetic characters, are they? They're awful.
Yeah, but they are not dressed as soldiers in the Second World War would have been. They're in 1930s kit.
Yeah.
You know, they're on leave.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and people, there's two soldiers in it. No. And the other thing about it is he's like quite schizophrenic. Supposed to be in the home counties, but the train station has all these things are going to Leeds, Bradford, and all that. And when they go out for that drive, they ain't in the home counties, are they? They're in this little stone bridge, which is definitely up in the Lake District or something. Now, I'm just saying, is that sort of thing where... Is that because she's protected? Oh, wouldn't it be lovely to be a bridge out in the countryside? The only place...
Or just a filming,
Somewhere in the suburbs we're going to go to.
Well, Atonement and the English Patient. So Atonement is also has a Second World War backdrop, a pre-Second World War and Second World War backdrop. And it piles on the tragedy. But they've both got this beautiful soundtrack with them as well. And the English Patient's Gabrielle Yared soundtrack is my favourite soundtrack of all time. I've played a couple of tracks from the English Patient before on the show. But I've never gone whole hog, and I'm going whole hog today, and I'm playing every 5 minutes of this track. this is my soundtrack, The English Patient.
This dirge from The English Patient.
I'm putting it back up. I'm putting it back up. Love, just the most beautiful soundtrack. Thank you, Gabriel Yared. Right, reviews. You're going to go first, aren't you?
Crime 101 with Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, Halle Berry and Barry Keoghan. A slick, fast-moving LA crime movie. And I've got to say, I didn't think they made these sorts of films anymore. This is terrific stuff. It really, really is. It's about 15 minutes too long, but then everything is nowadays. But this is this is, you know, it's so sharp you'd cut yourself on it. Chris Hemsworth is a very precise diamond thief. Everything's worked out, bish bash bosh, and the job's done. Hayley Berry is an insurance broker. Mark Ruffalo is a cop, and Barry Keoghan is this demonic sprite that just erupts into the film every 5 or 10 minutes and just causes chaos. It's just terrific. I loved it. Jennifer Jason Leigh turns up for one scene in it. Nick Nolte, and I think I was saying last week, because Nick Nolte looked as though he was dead.
Yes, you said yes.
Was it Die My Love? He looked so good. He never. Where you been, Nick?
Lynn Ramsey's film. Yeah.
He looked great. I just thought this was terrific, and I'd recommend it thoroughly if you want a good. I won't say old-fashioned because, you know...
But there's no knowing winks to camera kind of thing.
Everyone does it straight.
Yeah.
And Halle Berry is brilliant in it.
I'm definitely going to catch
it. She plays like a... They say what her age is. You're 53, you're over it, you know.
Oh, God.
Did that strike a nerve? She looks $1 million, but she can afford to look like that, can't she? But she was terrific. Everyone in it's terrific. Just go and see it.
Just go and see it, yeah. Well, continuing our doomed romance theme, the most famous and the most doomed of lovers, Kathy and Heathcliff in Emerald Fennell's new, not very faithful adaptation of Wuthering Heights. Mm. And there's fine, there's room for that. Read the trailer, I was like, you know, I'm happy that you do that if you want to do that. Make a big, lush, 80s-looking video out of it. I have to say my experience of it was somewhat hollow, though. It felt a bit long. There's things to enjoy in it, though. I'm really struggling with how to review it, though, because if you know... I mean, most people know the book, right? It cuts off about half of the novel. The boring bit at the end, and it is, it's sort of, she's widely talked about as a filmmaker that she just loved this book when she was 14, and just likes the idea of the sexy parts, if you know what I mean.
So she's making the lust.
Well, yeah, but I think 14-year-olds are a bit more savvy than
nowadays,
that. And I,
yeah.
So I'm not sure how people are going to respond to it, because I feel like some of the bits in it are a bit laughable,
right?
But others are quite enjoyable. Jacob Elordi, I mean, let's just briefly talk about the Yorkshire accent. I'm not quite sure what is Meckin to do with Tuckin there. And Margot Robbie's accent is a bit RP. Like, I don't know where Kathy has been brought up, but it's not in Yorkshire. Which is fine, I guess, but if it's meant to be like the Heath is a character in the novel, at least, and so it's got some lovely looking bits in it, but it doesn't come together as a whole for me. However, I go have a look, see what you think. Well, you won't go. I know you won't go.
And I'm not trying to disparage it or say anything. It's just not my thing.
I just think I really loved the revenge drama of Promising Young Women. Mm. I hated Saltburn, and I think I'm somewhere in between with this for me.
I think we're in complete agreement about those other two films. Mm. Promising Young Woman I thought was great, but Saltburn was a come on, wasn't it? Oh, really? You know, you just felt like you'd been tagged along for 2 hours.
And also, the only a rich person could have made that film of like, poor people are after your money, they want our stuff. So maybe I haven't forgiven her for that, and that's clouded my judgment on Wuthering Heights as well. Jacob Elordi does look very good when he comes back as, you know, made his money.
To be honest, I have enough of them in that Chanel number 5 ever. You know, they can't even get to each other's house. Two gorgeous looking dimwits.
I don't know how to rate that. Not a rate, not a hate, just somewhere in between.
Let's have to redo some of the music because she's gone on for so long.
Let's just do what's
on next week, and we could do one piece of music.
But we've got 5 minutes left.
Exactly.
Yeah. This piece of music's 2 minutes long.
We'll do the last one.
All right then.
That's better.
Okay.
I'd just like to say, the past 2 weeks, I've managed to get the final piece.
Well, no one needs to hear Lara's theme from
the fourth and final piece.
No one needs to hear Lara's theme.
I'm just saying.
Well, you've spent a minute doing that now. What's on new releases then? Come on, Secret Agent. We're going to go and see a preview of that on Monday at the Light, aren't we? You can speak now.
Oh, can I? Yeah. No. Yes. Yeah. Secret Agent.
Cold Storage. That's the one we did the trailer trash for the other week, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the one with Vanessa Redgrave and Leslie Manville.
If I Had Legs, I'd Kill You.
Yeah, Rose Byrne, which is up for an Oscar, isn't she, for it? I don't know much about it.
No. There's a Jeff Buckley documentary I'm going to catch this weekend. It's never over.
Just talking to Paul about it. I'm not a Jeff or Tim Buckley.
I'm really looking forward to that. And there's a special Paul McCartney, and I love Paul McCartney, Man on the Run documentary out this week, one night only. Catch that.
Oh, I will. I'll go along with some headphones.
Well, I'll like it. Shall we leave now?
Well, this time we are. Yeah. We're not going to be playing 30 seconds of the final.
Well, I'm going to leave you then with a track called Alligator, which is from the film Blue Valentine, our final doomed love of the show. Enjoy your films. Enjoy a romantic evening watching doomed love films, if you like. Try and catch Brief Encounter, a bottle of wine, some chocolate cake. That'd
all
be nice.
For me.
Yeah. You enjoy your films. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Yeah.